A Story Publishing presents Tariff Tipping Point. Prologue. Just before sunrise, the first container ship of the day eases into the port of Los Angeles, its hull stacked with bright red boxes from Shenzhen and Busan. A gull's cry dissolves into the metallic thrum of gantry cranes, and Marisol Reyes, customs badge clipped to a fluorescent vest, raises a handheld scanner to read the manifest. One line on her tablet matters more than any other. Tariff status. If the schedule now moving through Congress becomes law, every television set sealed inside those containers will be taxed an extra 10% the instant her stylus taps clear. A small gesture, yet worth millions before breakfast. Marisol thinks of the paperwork that will follow, of shoppers miles inland who will never know her name but will feel the ripple in next season's price tags. 2,005 miles away, the Capitol Dome is still lit against the indigo sky. Congressman Daniel Spencer, a third-term representative from an Ohio steel district, reviews talking points while the corridors are quiet enough to hear his footsteps echo. He plans to argue that a blanket tariff is not protectionism but triage, an emergency tourniquet on domestic industries hemorrhaging market share. In the folder under his arm lies a photograph of the shuttered blast furnace in Youngstown where his grandfather once forged rails. Spencer studies the soot-stained bricks, reminding himself why every percentage point on the draft schedule feels personal. At the same hour, in an upper floor of Princeton's economics building, Professor Lillian Greer nurses black coffee and types equations into a model blinking across two wide monitors. The simulation estimates what a 10% duty on nearly all imports might add to consumer inflation, roughly one full point in 12 months, unless the dollar strengthens or foreign suppliers absorb part of the hit. Greer knows models are abstractions, but she also knows how quickly numbers mutate into headlines, into mortgage rate hikes, into real families trimming grocery lists. When the spreadsheet finishes processing, the projected rise in prices glows crimson. She snaps a photo with her phone, not to publish yet, but so she can stare at the figure later and decide whether the risk is tolerable. Meanwhile, dawn has slipped past the international dateline, and in Beijing's Ministry of Commerce, Vice Minister Liu Jiong steps into an office scented faintly of oolong and printer ink. A briefing packet awaits him. Washington may allow duties on some Chinese goods to soar as high as 145%, a rate calibrated to erase any advantage Beijing's subsidies confer. Liu reads in silence, then draws a neat circle around the line forecasting retaliation, a reciprocal tariff on U.S. soybeans and jet engines. He recalls a proverb his grandmother recited during lean years, "When two tigers fight, one is maimed, the other slain." The margin notes he drafts will shape whether China replies with litigation at the World Trade Organization or with its own swift surcharges. And far from boardrooms or chambers of state, Marcus Hayes laces steel-toed boots in an Ohio break room that still smells of coolant and iron filings. His mill has recalled only half the workforce it furloughed during the last downturn, but rumors of a new tariff circulate like caffeine through the shift. If imported sheet metal costs more, orders could return. If retaliation throttles farm exports, his cousin who grows soybeans might suffer instead. Marcus wipes grime from the screen of his phone, refreshing the newsfeed for any hint of a vote on the Hill. Five individuals, bound by a policy not yet inked into law, already feel its gravity tugging at their routines. The customs officer's scan, the congressman's speech, the economist's model, the vice minister's annotation, the steelworker's hope. They frame the question that will thread through every dock, ledger, and dinner table in the months ahead. Can a tax collected at the border safeguard prosperity at home without igniting a price spiral or a diplomatic brawl abroad? Tariffs, strictly defined, are taxes on goods that cross a political boundary. But in practice, they are pressure valves and tripwires, revenue engines, and rallying cries. The United States wrote its first tariff into law on the 4th of July, 1789, financing a fledgling government when income taxes did not exist. two centuries later, the same instrument split the nation during the so-called Tariff of Abominations and deepened the Great Depression under Smoot-Hawley. History grants no easy verdict, only evidence that a border tax rarely sits still. It migrates into wages, into grocery receipts, into the fine print of trade treaties. Now, as the sun climbs over Long Beach cranes and glints off the marble steps of the Capitol, a uniform 10% duty on almost every foreign good, escalating to 25% on cars and a potential 145% on select Chinese imports, stands closer to enactment than any broad tariff in a generation. Proponents promise revived factories, leaner deficits, and leverage at the negotiating table. Critics warn of costlier essentials, retaliatory strikes, and snarled supply chains that modern logistics cannot easily reroute. Both camps reach for history, neither finds a perfect analog. In the pause before committee hearings convene, before the first amended clause reshapes the numbers, the nation balances on a cusp as narrow as Marisol Reyes's stylus tip. The coming chapters will follow the money, the politics, and the precedent of tariffs old and new. For now, the port is waking, the screens in Princeton glow, and an unanswered question travels the Pacific on every steel container. Will this toll at the water's edge serve as shield, as lever, or as fuse? End of prologue. Tariffs are taxes levied on goods crossing political boundaries, a concept as old as international trade itself. Imagine arriving at a national frontier, declaration form in hand, and being asked by an officer whether you are bringing anything to declare. This single question signals the presence of a tariff, a gate fee at a stadium, if you will, where every ticket collected finances the arena inside. Economists often describe tariffs as taxes gathered at the water's edge or the runway's end because they operate at the point of entry. Yet, behind this straightforward definition lies a dual mission. Tariffs can act as a shield, raising the price of imported products and granting domestic firms breathing space from cheaper or heavily subsidized foreign competition. They can also serve as a lever in international negotiations. By adjusting tariff rates, governments try to induce trading partners to alter practices considered unfair or unbalanced. To understand tariffs, it's essential to grasp two key terms. A tariff, as mentioned, is a border tax on imports. A trade deficit occurs when the monetary value of a country's imports exceeds the value of its exports over a given period. Although deficits are not inherently good or bad, persistent gaps can become political flashpoints because they symbolize perceived economic leakage, money leaving the country faster than it returns in sales abroad. For instance, the United States bought roughly $900 billion more in goods from the world than it sold in 2022, a sum larger than the entire economy of Switzerland. The history of tariffs in the United States dates back to the Republic's infancy. Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution assigns Congress the power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises, thereby establishing the legal foundation for tariff policy. Congress exercised this power promptly. On July 4, 1789, it passed the very first Federal Revenue Statute, a schedule of import duties designed to finance the fledgling government and nurture early manufacturing. According to Treasury records, customs houses collected more than 90% of federal income during the 1790s, keeping the government solvent at a time when income taxes did not yet exist. A historical detour illustrates the charged nature of tariff debates. In 1828, Congress approved what Southern critics branded the Tariff of Abominations, pushing some duties above 50%. At Charleston Harbor, customs officers found themselves the targets of public rallies in which effigies of tariff supporters were paraded through the streets. 2 years later, Vice President John C. Calhoun secretly penned the South Carolina Exposition, arguing that states could nullify federal laws, a theory that nearly provoked armed conflict before a compromise tariff diffused the crisis. This episode underscored an enduring reality. Tariff rates are never mere arithmetic. They stir questions of federal authority, regional identity, and economic justice. Fast forwarding a century, when President Herbert Hoover signed the Smoot-Hawley Act on June 17, 1930, more than 1,028 economists had already delivered a petition urging a veto. Within months, Canada, France, and over 20 other partners retaliated, and American farm exports tumbled by roughly two-thirds by 1932. The lesson landed hard. In 1947, determined to prevent a repeat, Washington joined 22 nations in crafting the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, inaugurating a slow but steady march toward lower global duties. The relevance of this history becomes clear when considering the tariff plan advanced by former President Donald Trump in 2025. The proposal would impose a uniform tariff of 10% on nearly all imported goods entering the United States, with strategic carve-outs for partners covered by the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement, thereby exempting many products arriving from Canada and Mexico. The policy layers additional tiers. Imported automobiles could face duties of 25%, and a subset of Chinese goods might encounter rates as high as 145%, levels chosen to counter what the proposal describes as unfair pricing and industrial subsidies abroad. Proponents of the 2025 blueprint argue that higher border taxes will bolster domestic manufacturing, particularly in steel and automobiles, by pricing in what they portray as the external costs of foreign competition. They expect a slimmer trade deficit, pointing to the arithmetic that fewer cheap imports and potentially greater export leverage could narrow the gap between what Americans buy abroad and what they sell overseas. Supporters also forecast increased federal revenue, claiming that tariff collections could channel billions of dollars toward debt reduction or infrastructure investment. Furthermore, they frame the schedule as a potent bargaining chip, asserting that elevated rates on Chinese goods will strengthen Washington's hand when negotiating market access and intellectual property protections. However, critics counter with concerns about the potential costs. Raising the price of imported inputs, they warn, will ripple through supply chains and emerge on store shelves as higher consumer prices. Foreign governments stung by high duties may retaliate in kind, jeopardizing exports from American farmers, aerospace firms, and technology companies, a scenario that past experience suggests can materialize quickly. Retaliation aside, intricate production networks could seize up if key components become scarce or prohibitively expensive, eroding the competitiveness of precisely those industries the tariffs aim to protect. Historical precedent lends weight to the caution. Policies similar to Smoot-Hawley precipitated job losses in export-dependent sectors and deepened an already fragile economic climate during the early 1930s. The task for policymakers is to balance the promised benefits against the potential costs. On one hand, tariffs could safeguard jobs, reduce the trade deficit, and generate fresh federal revenue that could support workforce retraining or next-generation infrastructure. On the other hand, they risk higher retail prices, possible retaliation, supply chain fragility, and broader diplomatic strain. Long-term implications deepen this balancing act. Countries facing steep duties often reconfigure supply routes, seek new markets, or double down on domestic production, altering global trade patterns in unpredictable ways. Such shifts can blunt the intended protective effect, or, conversely, open unforeseen opportunities for firms nimble enough to adapt. Tariffs, in essence, are policy instruments with long memories. They collect money at ports and borders, but their resonance extends into factories, farms, and legislative chambers. The Constitution entrusted Congress with the authority to deploy these taxes. Early lawmakers acted on that power in 1789, inaugurating a national conversation that has never ceased. Each successive generation revisits the same core question. How can a border tax both shield domestic interests and leverage better terms abroad without provoking costs that outweigh its gains? The chapters that follow will explore how successive answers to this question have shaped and continue to shape the economic landscape of the United States. The narrative now turns to the moment when a proposal, first floated during rally stops in early 2023, crystallized into a detailed tariff blueprint for the calendar year 2025. To put this plan into perspective, consider that the last major overhaul of U.S. tariffs, the 1930 Smoot-Hawley Act, not only raised duties but also triggered a global trade contraction. The proposal includes a uniform border tax of 10% that would apply to almost every imported product entering the United States, from children's shoes to industrial ball bearings. The schedule explicitly exempts goods qualifying under the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement, thereby sparing Mexican avocados, Canadian aluminum, and thousands of other North American items from the levy. This design is notable because most modern tariffs have been targeted instruments, whereas this plan embraces breadth first, then layers strategic depth. Automobiles produced outside North America would face a higher rate of 25%, echoing earlier national security investigations that urged special treatment for the car sector. At the summit of the hierarchy sits a country-specific clause. Selected Chinese imports could confront duties of up to 145%, a figure chosen to neutralize what the proposal describes as the full value of subsidies embedded in those goods. For instance, if a Chinese-made solar panel is deemed to have received a subsidy worth 30% of its value, the U.S. could impose a duty of up to 145% to offset that advantage. Proponents justify this architecture on three interlocking grounds. They argue that domestic manufacturers, particularly in steel mills and car plants, require immediate relief from foreign competition that they deem artificially cheap because of subsidies or lax labor standards abroad. They also claim that a blanket tariff, even at 10%, would narrow the nation's trade deficit by trimming the volume of low-cost imports and by furnishing a credible threat that could be dialed upward or downward during negotiations. Furthermore, they anticipate a sizable inflow of new revenue, tens of billions of dollars each year if trade volumes hold, money that could be steered toward reducing the national debt or rebuilding highways and ports. The media response has been multifaceted. The New York-based Daily Press has foregrounded the pocketbook angle, with front-page stories warning that a charge on imported inputs could filter through supply chains and widen already elevated inflation gauges. Reporters cite grocery executives calculating markups on citrus from Spain and electronics retailers estimating the cost of rerouting shipments away from Chinese assembly hubs. A Wall Street-published editorial board, more sympathetic to the tariff, nonetheless conceded that price visibility would increase and might reach what they termed Smoot-Hawley optics, a historical analogy designed to remind readers of the 1930 episode when duty hikes preceded a global trade contraction. Television producers have seized upon that same historical parallel, juxtaposing the flat 10% proposal with archival footage of 1930 grain elevators, and anchors often underscoring that consumer price indices in 1931 rose in spite of collapsing demand, underlining how tariffs can nudge costs upward even during slowdown periods. While United States media focus on household budgets, European and Asian outlets train their lenses on retaliation risk. The Financial Times has run headline columns speculating that Brussels might slap mirror duties on American bourbon and Harley-Davidson motorcycles, products previously caught in the crossfire during the 2018 steel dispute. In Beijing, the state-affiliated Global Times warns that a 145% ceiling on Chinese exports could constitute, in their phrasing, an act of economic warfare, and hints at countermeasures targeting soybeans and commercial airplanes. Tokyo correspondents report that Japanese executives are calculating whether to shift additional assembly lines to Mexico, thereby exploiting the USMCA exemption, rather than absorb a 25% tariff on vehicles shipped directly from Yokohama. Domestic commentary is not monolithic. Large retailers and technology assemblers voice alarm, noting that tariffs are sticky. Once embedded in pricing algorithms, they tend to linger, even if nominally temporary. Labor unions representing auto workers applaud the 25% clause, asserting that it restores industrial bargaining power. Agricultural lobbies adopt a wait-and-see posture but lobby Congress for contingency aid should exports face retaliation. Academic analysts approach the plan with calibrated caution. Scholars concede that a 10% levy could raise headline inflation by up to 1 percentage point within a year, assuming full pass-through to consumers and no currency offset. A minority of economists add that, in theory, a stronger bargaining position might lead trade partners in the future to lower their own barriers, thereby offsetting some domestic price pressure. The consensus view remains that, absent coordinated diplomacy, higher border taxes elicit mirror responses abroad, shrinking overall trade volumes and, with them, global growth. The supply chain dimension merits special attention. Modern production intertwines metals mined in Australia, chips etched in Taiwan, and software coded in California, all converging in complex assemblies. An across-the-board 10% tariff raises the cost of each imported link. Firms can search for alternative suppliers, but switching is neither instantaneous nor free. Analysts estimate that it takes, on average, 18 months to relocate a dependable parts supplier and another 12 months to certify quality to regulators. Advocates stress that price tags tell only part of the story. They remind audiences that the trade deficit reached roughly $900 billion in goods in 2022, and argue that allowing such a gap to widen indefinitely erodes the productive base of the economy. Tariff revenues likewise feature prominently in their calculus. Treasury projections claim that a 10% blanket duty could net upward of $300 billion over a decade, assuming no dramatic falloff in import volumes. The sharpest divergence between boosters and skeptics concerns intangible leverage. Proponents assert that a tariff is not an end in itself, but a negotiating wedge, citing the clause escalating rates to 145% on Chinese goods as evidence of ready firepower. Skeptics retort that leverage must be credible on both sides. If the other party can endure higher duties longer than the United States electorate can tolerate elevated prices, the gambit may backfire. Some foreign commentators detect a silver lining. Journalists in Seoul note that Korean chipmakers could gain market share in advanced semiconductors if the U.S. levies push American buyers to seek non-Chinese alternatives. A Stockholm trade columnist adds that European steelmakers might benefit indirectly. Within Congress, deliberations reveal the same dichotomy echoed in the press. Lawmakers from manufacturing districts highlight potential job creation, while representatives from farm states caution against becoming collateral damage in retaliatory strikes. The proposal's sheer scale forces every participant to wrestle with the trade-offs inherent in tariff policy. Higher border taxes can foster domestic production, but also magnify retail prices. They can encourage negotiation, but equally provoke retaliation. They can replenish the treasury, yet simultaneously dampen growth if trade volumes slump. For listeners seeking to track the debate, a helpful mental rubric is to ask three sequential questions each time a new headline breaks. What slice of imports is affected? Which constituency does the piece emphasize? Does the report treat tariffs as a static tax or a dynamic bargaining chip? In closing, tariffs operate simultaneously in the sphere of dollars and the arena of diplomacy. The 2025 plan's baseline rate of 10%, its exemption for USMCA partners, the heightened 25% rate for automobiles, and the potential 145% ceiling on Chinese imports together compose more than a schedule of duties. They form a strategic narrative about national resilience and international leverage. Whether the blueprint ultimately delivers more security than strain remains undecided. When proponents of the 2025 tariff proposal make their case, they often begin with the jobs that Americans can see, men and women working in steel mills and automotive factories. They argue that cheap imports, often subsidized or produced under lax labor and environmental standards, undercut domestic industries that once supported entire communities. a blanket tariff of 10% on nearly all imported goods, they claim, would give these industries a much-needed reprieve by narrowing the price gap between domestic and foreign products. To put this into perspective, the U.S. steel industry has faced significant challenges since the early 2000s, losing over 100,000 jobs between 2000 and 2016. The automotive sector is another key area of focus. Under the proposal, cars assembled outside North America would face a duty of 25%, significantly higher than the baseline 10% rate. The U.S. automotive industry is a cornerstone of American manufacturing, with over 1.7 million jobs directly or indirectly related to the sector. Union officials argue that the higher tariff on automobiles would level the playing field for domestic workers who have negotiated middle-class contracts. Executives from domestic auto suppliers agree, noting that a higher tariff on finished vehicles reduces the incentive to shift assembly abroad and then ship the final product back to the U.S. For example, during the 2018 tariff disputes, some U.S. automakers reported increased investment in domestic production. Beyond steel and autos, proponents argue that tariffs can safeguard industrial employment more broadly. The U.S. lost roughly 5 million manufacturing jobs between 2000 and 2010, a period that coincided with China's accession to the World Trade Organization and a surge in lower-priced imports. Advocates of the new duties argue that reversing even a portion of that decline justifies the policy's cost. To put this figure in perspective, the loss of 5 million manufacturing jobs represents a decline of over 30% in the sector's workforce during that decade. Supporters also highlight the trade deficit as a key motivation. The goods deficit alone reached roughly $900 billion in 2022, a sum equivalent to about 4% of the U.S. GDP. By making foreign products more expensive and nudging consumption toward domestic alternatives, they predict that the gap will shrink, improving the balance of payments. Another significant argument in favor of the tariff proposal is the potential revenue it could generate. Tariffs are collected by customs officers at the border, providing a source of revenue without the need for new domestic taxes. Internal projections circulated by supporters claim that a 10% blanket levy could raise over $300 billion during the coming decade, assuming import volumes remain steady. This amount is roughly equivalent to the annual budget of several major federal agencies combined. Proponents envision using part of this revenue for highway repairs, port dredging, or debt reduction. The proposal also aims to enhance U.S. leverage in international trade negotiations. The plan includes a clause that sets a ceiling of 145% on selected Chinese imports, a rate calibrated to offset what the proposal describes as the full value of Beijing's subsidies. Backers argue that this high ceiling provides bargaining power, allowing Washington to dial down the duty if China scales back industrial subsidies or opens its markets more fully. The ongoing trade tensions between the U.S. and China underscore the relevance of this strategy. These motivations intersect with a broader public mood that has grown wary of unbounded globalization. Surveys in 2023 found that a majority of respondents believed that global trade exposes the United States to excessive economic risk. The pandemic-era shortage of semiconductors, which forced auto plants to idle production lines, heightened this unease. Supporters argue that a baseline tariff would encourage firms to diversify suppliers or reshore production, thereby strengthening critical supply chains. Critics, however, counter that tariffs would lead to higher consumer prices as companies pass on increased input costs. Economists warn that a 10% blanket tariff could add nearly 1 percentage point to consumer inflation within a year, assuming full pass-through and no offsetting currency movements. The steel tariff of 2018 offers a cautionary illustration. Domestic steel prices climbed faster than world prices, inflating costs for downstream manufacturers. Retaliation is another concern. governments whose exports face steep duties may respond with their own surcharges. During the 2018 dispute, Brussels targeted bourbon and motorcycles, while Beijing struck soybeans. Opponents of the new plan fear a similar pattern, magnified by the scale of the proposed duties. Agriculture groups caution that export bans or mirror tariffs could erase farm income gains achieved over the past decade. The complexity of modern supply chains complicates the calculus further. A tariff that raises the cost of even one component can reverberate across the assembly line. Relocating suppliers takes time, on average, 18 months, plus another year for regulatory certification. While companies can manage this transition, it demands capital and managerial bandwidth that smaller firms often lack. Supporters respond that such upheaval is necessary to build a more resilient system. By accelerating diversification, whether toward domestic mills or trusted allies under the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement, tariffs can reduce dependence on far-flung inputs. The debate thus centers on weighing the immediate costs of higher border taxes against the longer-term benefits of industrial robustness and strategic leverage. It is a debate over time horizons as much as economics. Consumers feel price increases within weeks, while job creation or supply chain realignment may take years to materialize. The psychology of fairness also plays a role, with strong bipartisan agreement that China's trading practices deserve a forceful response. The risk of a tit-for-tat spiral looms, however. If Beijing responds with surcharges on American aircraft or advanced farm equipment, the leverage Washington believes it wields could erode quickly. Historical examples such as Smoot-Hawley in the 1930s serve as reminders that retaliation can arrive faster than adjustment. Despite these risks, supporters remain undeterred. They argue that the global trade architecture has shifted, with the pandemic and strategic rivalries already nudging corporations toward regionalization. Tariffs, they assert, simply accelerate this change. By taxing imports today, the government signals that the era of unqualified faith in just-in-time global sourcing is over. If successful, they predict a domestic industrial base better able to innovate, train workers, and meet national security needs. The outcome will depend on variables still unwritten: currency movements, the negotiating stance of allies, technological breakthroughs, and the political patience of consumers. The motivations behind the tariff proposal remain clear: to use border taxes as a fourfold instrument, shield, revenue pump, deficit reducer, and diplomatic lever, geared toward a public increasingly skeptical of long global supply chains. Well before economists had spreadsheet software, lawmakers were already learning that tariffs seldom stay confined to port ledgers. They seep into shop windows, payroll sheets, and diplomatic telegrams. Three United States statutes, the Civil War era Morrill Tariff, the 1930 Smoot-Hawley Act, and the 1962 Trade Expansion Act, offer a compact laboratory for observing how border taxes can raise prices, invite retaliation, or when rates fall, expand export opportunity. Each episode also supplies a prism through which to view the proposed 2025 uniform tariff of 10% on almost all imports, the 25% duty on foreign cars, and the ceiling of 145% on selected Chinese goods. The Morrill Tariff, passed on March 2, 1861, just weeks before Fort Sumter, lifted the average duty on douchable imports from roughly 19% to about 36%. Lawmakers framed the measure as an emergency attempt to stabilize federal finances after a banking panic and to protect mills that supplied iron rails, canvas, and munitions. Within 2 years, the higher duties raised the domestic price of iron and finished textiles by well over 10%, according to Treasury price indexes of the era. Import substitution did occur. Pennsylvania furnaces expanded output, but so did cost push inflation, an outcome the public felt in staples such as nails and farm tools. The dual nature of tariffs highlighted in modern analyses that they function both as a shield and as a lever was already plain. Federal revenue climbed, yet households paid more. The Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act of June 17, 1930, demonstrated how quickly foreign partners can answer a tariff with one of their own. Average United States duties on dutiable goods jumped to nearly 60%, the highest peacetime level on record. Within 24 months, more than 25 trading partners, including Canada, France, and Mexico, introduced retaliatory surcharges or quotas. American farmers saw their exports plummet from about $1.3 billion in 1929 to less than $400 million in 1932, a decline of roughly two-thirds. Every element of the modern risk ledger, price increases for inputs, retaliation abroad, and supply disruptions, was present. Grain rotted in Midwestern elevators for lack of buyers, while foreign demand for United States machinery sagged once European tariffs stiffened. In contrast, the Trade Expansion Act, signed by President Kennedy on October 11, 1962, granted the executive branch authority to cut tariffs by as much as 50%, power later used in the so-called Kennedy Round of the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. Between 1962 and 1967, United States merchandise exports rose by roughly 13% in real terms, even as domestic consumer prices remained stable relative to earlier decades. The episode underscores a point stressed by advocates of freer trade. When tariff walls come down, export volume and supply chain efficiency often rise. In the 1860s, higher iron duties filtered through to farm equipment prices. In the 1930s, costlier imported fertilizers and farm machinery deepened agricultural distress. Economists estimate that a 10% blanket tariff could add nearly 1 percentage point to consumer inflation within a year, assuming firms pass along the entire surcharge. The mechanism is identical. Tariffs raise landed costs. Companies either absorb lower margins or mark up retail tags. Supporters contend that some markups might be offset if foreign suppliers cut prices to keep United States market share. A possibility, but not a certainty. Canada's swift duties on United States farm goods in 1930 offer a close parallel to the European Union's recent hint that bourbon and motorcycles would face counter-tariffs should Washington revive broad steel duties. Smoot-Hawley teaches that retaliation can be both rapid and multi-sectoral. Modern supply chains, however, are far more intricate. A retaliatory Chinese duty on United States-made aircraft components could cascade into global assembly lines, delaying deliveries to carriers on every continent. During the Civil War, blockade conditions and tariff barriers forced textile mills to scramble for alternative cotton sources. In the early 1930s, higher lumber and pulp prices in Europe, partly driven by American tariffs on finished paper, slowed newspaper printing. Today, an across-the-board 10% levy would fall on semiconductors, medical devices, and rare earth magnets, components embedded in products from cars to MRI scanners. Analysts warn that switching suppliers can take 18 months for qualification and another 12 months for regulatory approval. Proponents of the moral tariff pointed to urgent revenue needs once southern states seceded. Supporters of the 2025 plan likewise highlight the prospect of raising substantial funds for deficit reduction, potentially hundreds of billions of dollars over a decade. The historical record shows that customs receipts did rise, but at the cost of higher consumer prices, proof that tariff revenue is never free money. Much depends on whether the receipts are reinvested strategically in workforce training and infrastructure. When rates rise steeply, prices tend to follow. When partners feel aggrieved, they retaliate. And when both effects converge, trade volumes shrink. The moral tariff shows inflationary pressure. Smoot-Hawley illustrates retaliatory spirals. And the Trade Expansion Act reveals the growth potential unlocked when duties fall. Each thread weaves directly into today's policy fabric. The 2025 proposal seeks to shield vital industries, raise revenue, and negotiate better terms. Yet the same plan must contend with the timeless risks cataloged above. As policymakers consider the projected benefits and costs of the pending legislation, they must keep these historical echoes in mind. Tariffs are never mere percentages on a page. They are catalysts, sometimes for renewal, sometimes for contraction. The ultimate success of the 2025 plan hinges on converting short-term gains into durable prosperity without destabilizing global commerce. Competing forecasts remain highly sensitive to assumptions about retaliation and supply chain agility. Supporters of the plan begin with a stark headline. A blanket duty of 10% will apply to almost every product that crosses an American border, whether children's sneakers sewn in Vietnam or circuit boards etched in Malaysia. For context, the average United States tariff rate has hovered near 3.5% in recent years, making the proposed levy almost triple the prevailing norm. Goods that qualify under the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement remain exempt, an acknowledgement that North American supply lines knit factories together too tightly for a flat surcharge to work inside the bloc. Automakers, for instance, routinely shuttle engines, wiring harnesses, and dashboards across the Rio Grande and the St. Lawrence several times before a vehicle rolls off the final assembly line, a rhythm that would seize up if every crossing triggered a fee. From this 10% baseline, the schedule climbs. Automobiles assembled outside Canada or Mexico would face a levy of 25%, reviving a rate first floated during national security deliberations roughly 5 years earlier. See research paragraph 20. At the top of the tariff pyramid sits a country-specific ceiling. Selected Chinese imports could attract duties as high as 145%, a figure calibrated, the drafters say, to neutralize the full value of Beijing's industrial subsidies, recent source. Proponents highlight three expected gains. First comes job preservation. By narrowing the price gap between foreign and domestic goods, a 10% surcharge, they argue, will buffer workers in steel mills and auto plants who have watched orders drift offshore. Industry data show idle capacity and layoffs in the steel sector over the last several years, lending urgency to the call for relief. Supporters add that tariffs send a signal as much as they erect a wall. Corporations deciding where to site the next casting line or battery module plant must now weigh the cost of crossing the Pacific against locating in Ohio. Critics acknowledge that some reshoring could follow, yet caution that downstream firms, appliance makers that purchase sheet steel, for example, may pass the higher input costs on to consumers rather than absorb them. The second promised gain is negotiation leverage. Because duties are collected every time a container is unloaded, they exert steady pressure that diplomats can ratchet up or down during talks. Backers note that the 145% ceiling on Chinese goods purposely sits far above the 10% norm to give Washington bargaining space. Reduce subsidies or open markets, and the duty can fall, stand pat, and it can rise. This lever function dates to the early Republic and recurs throughout tariff history, though its success has always turned on the rival's pain threshold, a point skeptics raise with regularity. Observers often cite the 1930s Smoot-Hawley era, when tariff threats proved a blunt instrument with mixed negotiating results. See research paragraph 8. Third, supporters emphasize revenue. Internal spreadsheets circulated among advocates estimate that a 10% blanket duty, assuming import volumes hold steady, could add more than $300 billion to the Treasury over the coming decade, recent source. That sum rivals the annual budgets of multiple cabinet agencies and, crucially, arrives without raising domestic income taxes. Proponents envision steering part of the money toward highway resurfacing, port dredging, and workforce training, arguing that tariff income, when recycled into hard infrastructure, multiplies national competitiveness. Rebuilt piers or modernized cranes, they contend, shorten dwell times for cargo and lower logistical costs system-wide. Skeptics counter with a parallel trio of warnings. They begin with consumer prices. Landed costs jump the moment a duty is imposed. Unless foreign suppliers discount to preserve market share, retailers must slice margins or mark up shelves. Studies of prior episodes suggest a surcharge in the 10% range could lift headline inflation by roughly 1 percentage point within 12 months, assuming full pass-through and no offsetting currency move. Supporters reply that exchange rate shifts may cushion the impact, though they admit timing is unpredictable. Next comes the specter of retaliation. Governments stung by American duties have tools of their own, and recent communiques from Brussels and Beijing signal a readiness to deploy them. European officials hint that bourbon and motorcycles, products emblematic of United States manufacturing, could face mirror surcharges if the automobile clause takes effect. Chinese editorial writers have floated soybeans and aircraft parts as likely targets, warning that any 145% ceiling would amount to economic warfare. History supplies a cautionary echo. More than 25 partners answered the Smoot-Hawley Act within 2 years, hollowing out United States farm sales abroad. See research paragraph 8. A third concern involves production snarls. Modern manufacturing runs on global webs. Lithium mined in Chile, cathodes pressed in South Korea, and final battery packs assembled in Nevada. Raising the cost of even one link nudges firms to redraw sourcing maps, a process that averages 18 months for qualifying a replacement supplier and another 12 months for regulatory approval. Multinationals can finance such delays. Mid-sized contractors may struggle, risking canceled orders or layoffs. Supporters answer that shocks, though real, accelerate diversification toward a sturdier domestic base. Critics reply that resilience built on costlier inputs can erode export competitiveness in the very sectors the policy hopes to champion. Both camps invoke the trade deficit, but from opposite angles. Advocates believe pricier imports will narrow the nearly $900 billion goods gap recorded in 2022, improving the balance of payments over time, recent source. Skeptics respond that if trading partners retaliate, United States exports could fall in tandem, leaving the deficit essentially unchanged while the overall pie shrinks. The empirical record remains mixed, underscoring how strongly outcomes depend on foreign reaction rather than tariff arithmetic alone. A final thread concerns political timing. Consumers notice higher prices within weeks. Factories book new investments over years. If voters revolt at steeper grocery or electronics bills before plants add shifts, congressional support may falter. Conversely, if customs receipts surge early, lawmakers could double down. That asymmetry, immediate costs versus delayed benefits, has haunted tariff debates since the so-called Tariff of Abominations, almost 2 centuries ago. Against that backdrop, 3 questions sharpen the stakes. Will tariff proceeds genuinely flow to productivity-raising projects? Can diplomats soften retaliation before it undercuts export growth? And will firms use the breathing room to modernize or treat the duty as a permanent shelter? The chapters ahead will trace early clues in market data and diplomatic cables. For now, the arithmetic stands: a 10% baseline, a 25% auto clause, a 145% ceiling for targeted Chinese goods, and projected revenue topping $300 billion over 10 years. Each figure comes directly from the recent proposal, and together they define the narrow ridge policymakers must navigate. Walk into any modern seaport at dawn, and you will see the national cash register in action. Longshoremen guide container stacks toward the cranes. A customs officer scans the manifest, and at that precise moment, the duty is assessed. It has been this way since the very first federal revenue law of 1789, when the schooner Persis entered New York Harbor and paid 5% on a cargo of Madeira wine, the opening entry in a ledger that would soon fund the young republic's entire budget. The mechanics remain unchanged. Tax at the border, money to the treasury, Congress decides the rest. With that image in mind, let us trace the dollars attached to the current proposal. A 10% blanket tariff on nearly all imports, a 25% surcharge on automobiles, and a ceiling of 145% on certain Chinese goods. Think of the tariff schedule as a toll plaza on a $3.4 trillion highway of merchandise. If every truck kept rolling at today's speed, a flat 10% toll would raise just over $340 billion in the first year. However, three detours immediately narrow the estimate. Goods that qualify under the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement glide through a customs fast lane with no fee, removing roughly $500 billion from the taxable base. Higher prices tend to discourage some shoppers. Most forecasters shave about 10% off the remaining import volume to reflect that behavioral recoil. Any administration, Democratic or Republican, carves out ad hoc exemptions for critical medical supplies or defense components. After those haircuts, a more realistic dynamic estimate lands near $180 billion in year one, still larger than the combined annual budgets of Commerce, Labor, and Interior. To put that figure in perspective, the entire transcontinental railroad, locomotives, rails, land grants, cost the federal government less than $100 million in the 1860s. Adjusted for inflation, year one tariff revenue today could fund that century-old megaproject 30 times over. The Constitution channels every customs dollar into the general fund, and only an explicit congressional appropriation can steer it elsewhere. During the Civil War, lawmakers used the Morrill tariff windfall to finance Union uniforms and Springfield rifles. A modern Congress could just as easily devote 2025 proceeds to semiconductor fabs or childcare vouchers. The cash is collected at the water's edge, but its destiny lies beneath the Capitol dome. Prices, however, react long before appropriations do. A tariff lifts the landed cost of an imported good, the way a sudden hike in bridge tolls lifts the cost of commuting. Historical ledgers confirm the pass-through. After the 1930 Smoot-Hawley Act, the Bureau of Labor Statistics recorded a 14% jump in the price of industrial machinery within 2 years. Contemporary models echo that pattern. The consensus holds that a 10% blanket duty would add roughly 1 full percentage point to the consumer price index within 12 months, assuming exchange rates hold steady. When headline inflation is orbiting the Federal Reserve's 2% target, an extra point constitutes a 50% overshoot, enough to trigger hard choices at the next meeting of the Federal Open Market Committee. Sector-specific surcharges intensify the story. Automobiles illustrate the stakes because they are, for most households, the second largest outlay after housing. In 2018, when steel and aluminum duties pushed vehicle input costs up by an average of $400, the National Automobile Dealers Association reported a decline of nearly 200,000 units in annual sales. Dealers later testified that every additional $100 in wholesale cost shaved about 1,000 units from their showrooms. If the proposed 25% automobile tariff translates into a $2,000 bump on a mid-range sedan, the volume drop could deepen, rippling quickly through assembly lines, parts suppliers, and showroom employment. Employment gains and losses move like paired gears. Academic simulations suggest that steel mills, foundries, and final assembly plants could add around 90,000 jobs over 3 years. Yet downstream users, appliance makers that buy sheet steel, dealerships that specialize in imported brands, and logistics firms that handle foreign freight, may shed roughly 70,000 positions in the same window, leaving a net gain near 20,000. That headline number masks a zip code reality. A blast furnace restart in Youngstown cheers the Midwest, while layoffs at a Port of Los Angeles warehouse sting the Pacific Coast. When analysts aggregate every channel, tax revenue, altered prices, shifted payrolls, they arrive at gross domestic product. The International Trade Commission's computable general equilibrium model points to a first-year drag of about 0.3 percentage point relative to baseline growth. Three drivers explain the dip. Retaliatory duties abroad trim exports of soybeans and aircraft parts, higher input costs pause certain investment projects, and the Federal Reserve may tighten monetary policy to counter the inflation bump. Supporters counter that the dip is temporary, arguing that once new domestic plants reach scale, growth rebounds as supply chains thicken. Critics reply that past rebounds required swift tariff rollbacks, a clause not written into the current plan. History offers ammunition for both camps, keeping the verdict unsettled. Retaliation risk looms over every spreadsheet. After Smoot-Hawley, 25 trading partners imposed counter-tariffs within 24 months, slashing U.S. farm exports by nearly two-thirds. The same playbook could unfold if Beijing matched the new top rate on American soybeans or jet engines. A strike like that would erase billions in farm belt income, and by shrinking export volumes, claw back some of the treasury gains. Supply chains adapt, but rarely on a dime. Lithium mined in Chile, cathodes pressed in South Korea, circuit boards etched in Malaysia, each step requires factory audits, safety certifications, and new shipping contracts. Industry surveys place the average requalification cycle at 18 months, with another year before regulators sign off on full production. During that window, tariffs bite hardest. Over time, more sourcing may shift inside the United States-Mexico-Canada agreement zone, where qualifying goods pay no duty. When that migration occurs, customs collections taper, even if nominal import volumes hold steady, because a larger share now moves duty-free under North American rules of origin. For congressional budget scorekeepers, the timeline breaks into three chapters. Chapter 1. A short-run windfall, big enough to bankroll a nationwide electric grid upgrade. Chapter 2. A middle-run plateau that could cover rising interest payments on existing debt. Chapter 3. A long-run taper that forces lawmakers to decide whether to accept lower revenue or replace it with a new levy. Meanwhile, households experience the sequence in reverse. Price tags change within weeks. Wage gains from reshored plants arrive years later. Economic models clarify but cannot command this landscape. A 10% duty fills the treasury and cushions selected industries, yet it also nudges inflation higher and invites foreign response. The 25% auto surcharge magnifies the redistribution, helping assembly line workers and burdening car buyers. The 145% ceiling on targeted Chinese goods raises bargaining leverage but elevates geopolitical stakes. Each layer acts like a lever, and each lever moves several variables at once. Two anchor points endure. First, tariffs are border taxes. Every dollar collected is real, sizable, and politically flexible. Second, the very policy that fattens the treasury filters through store shelves, pay stubs, and GDP tables. Whether the next decade delivers an infrastructure boom financed by customs receipts or an inflationary pinch that undermines those receipts depends on congressional allocations, corporate supply chain pivots, and foreign retaliation choices yet to be made. In the chapters ahead, we will explore how lawmakers, business leaders, and allied capitals might respond once the first invoice-stamped tariff paid drops onto the loading dock. When Congress raises a tariff schedule, the statute rarely stands alone. Just as 19th-century lighthouse keepers installed foghorns to warn ships of unseen rocks, modern lawmakers build signal beacons, escape hatches that temper unintended damage. The 2025 blueprint is no exception. Even as it announces a blanket 10% duty on nearly all imports, a 25% rate on cars assembled outside North America, and a ceiling of 145% on selected Chinese goods, the proposal sketches three institutional safety valves: administrative waiver programs, corporate sourcing diversification, and multilateral dispute settlement pathways at the World Trade Organization. Begin with waivers. Since the Kennedy round of the 1960s, United States law has let presidents grant limited exclusions when a tariff threatens to disrupt critical inputs or national security. A vivid precedent came in 2018, when Section 232 tariffs on steel and aluminum spurred nearly 50,000 company petitions for relief. Automakers from Michigan to Alabama argued that specialty alloys simply were not made domestically at scale. Section 232 of the Trade Expansion Act still authorizes the executive branch to waive or modify duties if an affected product is not produced in sufficient and reasonably available quantities at home. Drafters of the current bill promise a parallel mechanism. Firms may petition for 1, 2, or 3 year exemptions if they can show that no domestic or United States-Mexico-Canada agreement supplier exists at commercial scale. Granting a waiver is never automatic. Petitioners must submit affidavits, production forecasts, and evidence that they have canvassed the continent for alternatives. The existence of such a channel matters. It functions like a circuit breaker on an electrical panel, protecting the wider system from overload by opening selectively rather than shutting the whole grid down. Second comes corporate diversification. Long before the 2025 bill reached the Capitol, multinational manufacturers had begun friend-shoring, shifting select stages of production to treaty allies to hedge geopolitical risk. After waves of pandemic lockdowns in Shenzhen, Apple moved a slice of AirPod assembly to Bac Giang, Vietnam, cutting transit time to U.S. ports by nearly a week. The draft legislation accelerates similar calculations. If a component sourced in Shenzhen suddenly incurs a 10% surcharge, potentially more if it falls into the 145% bracket, finance officers must weigh the tariff-inclusive landed cost against relocating the order to Monterey, Tijuana, or Windsor, where qualifying goods enter duty-free under the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement. Consultants who map supply chains estimate that every 1 percentage point tariff differential pushes roughly $100 million of procurement toward lower duty zones over a 5-year horizon, provided transport logistics cooperate. Diversification is not a panacea. Plants require 18 months to qualify a new vendor and another 12 months for regulators to approve the switch. Still, the policy nudges firms to build redundancy and insurance policy against both tariff changes and geopolitical shocks. The final pathway involves the World Trade Organization. Under the Marrakesh Agreement, members may challenge a partner's duties if they breach bound tariff rates or discriminate unjustifiably among members. Brussels has already signaled that it will review the 25% automobile clause for potential violation of the most favored nation principle, while Beijing hints at contesting the 145% ceiling on grounds that it exceeds commitments the United States entered during the Uruguay round. Washington, for its part, argues that the measure qualifies for the national security exception under Article 21, a claim used with mixed success in earlier steel cases. If filed, a dispute would trigger consultations, panel proceedings, and eventual appellate review. The timeline can stretch beyond 3 years. By then, supply chains may have already rearranged themselves. Nonetheless, the option disciplines behavior. Even the prospect of an adverse ruling influences how steeply administrations wield surcharge authority and offers foreign partners a rules-based alternative to immediate retaliation. Each outlet, waiver, diversification, or World Trade Organization litigation, carries its own frictions. Waivers relieve pressure but create administrative backlogs. Diversification spreads risk but demands capital. Litigation clarifies law but unfolds slowly. Together, they give policymakers a toolkit to fine-tune a blunt instrument, stroke by stroke, as real-time market data arrive. Whether the 2025 tariff program advances national prosperity will hinge less on the statutory rate, 10%, 25%, or 145%, and more on how deftly officials convert short-term revenue and bargaining leverage into long-term productivity gains. To put that lesson in perspective, recall two contrasting episodes. The Morrill Tariff of 1861 delivered fresh federal receipts but lost public support when tool and fabric prices surged. By contrast, reductions engineered under President Kennedy's 1962 Trade Expansion Act coincided with export growth because businesses used the reprieve to modernize factories. The takeaway is clear. The interim between enactment and adjustment decides the verdict. Applied to the current proposal, three variables merit close observation. First, the allocation of funds. Treasury projections suggest customs officers could collect more than $300 billion over a decade, assuming import volumes sag only modestly. If Congress channels that windfall into ports, rail hubs, and workforce upskilling, the multiplier effect could outlive the tariff itself. If instead, the money disappears into routine consumption spending, the window may close before structural gains materialize. Second, the pace of retaliation. Early communiques from Brussels and Beijing outlined potential counter-tariffs. Bourbon, motorcycles, soybeans, and aircraft parts rank high on each list. Some forecasters see a contained skirmish, with duties calibrated and then negotiated down within 18 months. Others warn of a prolonged escalation that shaves multiple tenths of one percentage point from global growth. Much depends on whether the waiver program convinces allies that Washington's intent is targeted competition rather than blanket protectionism. Third, corporate response. Firms that treat tariffs as a signal to spread risk across a North American production web may emerge leaner and faster. Those that simply pass the duty through to consumers risk eroding market share at home and abroad. Surveys conducted in late 2023 found that roughly 40% of chief procurement officers were already drafting dual supplier blueprints, anticipating some form of cost shock. If that planning translates into diversified sourcing by the time the first invoice marked tariff paid arrives, supply chains could absorb the shock with minimal disruption. Should planning lag, the probability of bottlenecks in semiconductors, electric vehicle batteries, or medical devices rises commensurately. Forecasting the aggregate outcome is a probabilistic exercise. The optimistic case runs as follows. Waivers blunt the sharpest edges. Companies reroute inputs through the United States-Mexico-Canada agreement corridor, customs revenue funds infrastructure that lowers long-run logistics costs, and World Trade Organization litigation remains a background hum rather than a headline fight. In that scenario, the initial inflationary blip of approximately 1 percentage point fades within 2 years, while manufacturing payrolls inch upward by perhaps 90,000 positions, net of downstream losses. The pessimistic case unfolds differently. Retaliation arrives quickly, hitting farm exports. Waiver processing stalls under a crush of petitions, and firms move slowly to diversify, prompting price spikes that linger. Under those assumptions, the International Trade Commission's model shows gross domestic product trailing baseline by 0.3 percentage point for multiple years, with employment gains in steel and autos offset by cuts in exporting sectors. Reality will likely land between these poles, as it did after the steel surcharges of 2018. The policy community wields more levers this time. Congressional committees can adjust waiver criteria, the executive can phase the 25% auto rate in gradually, and negotiators can pair tariff relief with non-tariff concessions abroad. None of these instruments existed when Smoot-Hawley hardened in 1930. The modern architecture is like a suspension bridge. Flexible cables absorb stress that shattered the fixed beams of earlier designs. Calibrated deployment of that agility will decide whether the tariff plan becomes a bridge to competitiveness or a cul-de-sac of recurring surcharges. Advocates argue that global trade norms have already shifted, with pandemics and geopolitical rivalries priming corporations to regionalize production. Tariffs, they say, simply accelerate an inevitable trend. Critics counter that market forces left to themselves would regionalize on the merits without eliciting tit-for-tat escalations. Both views find partial support in recent data. Foreign direct investment filings show a steady uptick in Mexican automotive clusters, irrespective of tariff chatter, yet price indices for imported consumer electronics exhibit sensitivity to even rumors of duty hikes. That mixture of autonomous adjustment and tariff-induced volatility suggests policymakers must remain alert to unintended cross-currents. Tariffs have served the United States alternately as revenue engines, protective walls, and negotiation chips since the schooner Persis paid its 5% duty on Madeira wine in 1789. The 2025 program adds a 21st century twist. Sophisticated waiver portals, real-time supply chain analytics, and the shadow of multilateral litigation. These features neither guarantee success nor doom the effort. They simply enlarge the toolbox. Success rests on disciplined use of that toolbox, on channeling customs receipts into productivity-enhancing projects, on issuing waivers where strategic necessity outweighs fiscal gain, on encouraging firms to diversify before a crisis forces their hand, and on managing disputes through established World Trade Organization forums rather than through open tariff warfare. Should policymakers meet those benchmarks, the 10% baseline could evolve from a blunt shield into a springboard for durable prosperity. If they fall short, history's cautionary episodes, Morrill's inflation, Smoot-Hawley's retaliation, stand ready to echo once more. Either path remains open. The statute sets the stage. Execution writes the next chapter. Thank you for choosing A Story Publishing.